Welcome to the Troubadour Podcast. Today I'll be reading The Mask of the Red Death by Edgar Allan Poe. Now I'm reading this April 4th, 2020, during the outbreak and the quarantine in America due to COVID-19 or the novel coronavirus. What's interesting about literature is how it can solidify certain values throughout time and certain human experiences. It could oscillate them. It can capture them, put them in an ossified form, and hold it there for all eternity so that we in future generations can look back and reflect and contemplate. The piece in and of itself that we will be reading is worthy of contemplation in any era, during Poe's time, during our time, in the future. And it is one that is powerful in our current predicament. The Mask of the Red Death is essentially is a very short story. It's one of his shorter ones. It's only a few pages. I believe it takes me about 17 minutes to read it. And it's about what it sounds like. Mask, by the way, is MASQUE. It's short for masquerade, the Italian masquerade balls that were held commonly. Often you would hold a mask to your face. You may have seen this in movies, for instance. But you didn't have to. This was not a mandatory thing of all masquerades. And a masquerade is generally a show or pretense, if you look it up. It's a ball, a fete, as they might put it, a festival. And they put the word fete, or Poe puts that word in this short story. Now, in this story, I'm just going to give you a quick synopsis here. In this short story, there is a plague going on. And there is a devastating plague, much, much worse, by the way, than the COVID-19 plague. This is worse even, the Red Death is worse even than the bubonic plague. The bubonic plague of history, which wiped out about a third of Europe, could kill a man in about 24 hours if you were completely untreated. You just take it in, about 24 hours later, he might be dead. And the kill ratio was very high. It was, as far as we can tell, you know, closer to 100% if you caught it. Now, so that's nothing like what we're experiencing today, of course. Thank goodness. But there are still some similarities in terms of just the virality of this and the effects that it has on individuals and on a culture. So the Mask of the Red Death and the Red Death that we're going to be hearing about kills in about 30 minutes. So it's even more deadly in Poe's version than the bubonic plague and much more deadly than the COVID-19 that we're dealing with. Now, in the story, there is a Prince Prospero who takes 1,000 of his revelers, 1,000 of his followers and hangers-on, and takes them into his castle, in his crenellated castle. He surrounds it so there's no egress or ingress. That means no way in or out. Everyone is locked in to this castle. So they're safe from the outside world. They're isolated from the outside world. That may sound familiar for some of us talking about isolation, about social distancing, about quarantining ourselves away from everybody. And in this quarantine, Prince Prospero puts on a masquerade for the revelers there. And they have a grand old time, a party. And this happens in a part of his castle that he has designed very meticulously with his kind of madness that he's possibly has into 7 rooms with 7 different colors. And you'll hear about the colors that as they go in, blue, green, purple, and then eventually black. Now, during this revel, a masked man comes and he looks like a person with the Red Death. That's described, this plague, earlier on. And then what happens, we'll save for later. But I wanted to have that simple synopsis. And if you think it's kind of bizarre that a rich person with trap themselves in with a group of revelers, then I suggest you look at the King of Thailand right now. I just read an article about the King of Thailand, who has set up a harem with him and 20 women, and he's blocked himself away from everybody else. I'm also reminded, and I think often, of the celebrities in America today. Now, what's odd about the celebrities in America today is that they often, my personal view is I believe they're all pretty fake and vain, and that a lot of the show that they put about caring about things are false. Now, this is my own personal opinion. If you don't buy into that, that's fine. But I often see, you know, moments where they really don't care about individuals and the lives that they may affect, because they often put forth ideas that will harm people, but they don't care because it's for a good cause in their mind. Now, putting that aside and politics aside is not important. What is not the most important thing at the moment. What's relevant to this is how, you know, I've seen some celebrities who are standing in their palatial homes, in their private gyms, like The Rock has been doing, and talking about how it's so important that we all self-isolate, that we all stay home, and that we just do this for as long as necessary, even though there are no reasons why we should assume that this will end anytime soon in terms of the COVID virus, that it'll go away. We have no plans for that, so we're supposed to stay in here forever. So these celebrities are admonishing us for going out, and they're saying stay home. They're, of course, in their palatial palaces, and you can imagine that they are probably reveling it up, even though they're not showing us, right? You can imagine the bacchanals in the back rooms of these places that they're not going to show us, because they know that they would be lambasted for it. And this is the kind of thing that, you know, is going on a regular basis. And Prince Prospero is a good example. And we're going to look a little bit at the psychology of this after I do the reading, because we'll see that there's something else going on in the story and in the elements of the story that we're seeing in Poe's examples and in his illustrations of the household of the revelers of the ebony clock, and what this says about Prince Prospero. Now, I want to read one quick passage of Shakespeare to kind of set this all up for you. Because Prince Prospero is more than likely, in my opinion, a call out, a shout out, a reflection, a building on of Shakespeare's The Tempest, and the mage in there is called Prospero. Both characters, the Prince Prospero in The Mask of the Red Death and Prospero in The Tempest, are noblemen who try to use their power and wealth to control the people around them. So we'll discuss this more later. But I want to read this to you to kind of give you an idea. You'll see in here the seven ages of men, and this of a man, I should say, not of men, of a man, the seven ages of man. And what that means is that all men go through these seven ages, and you'll see what I mean. And I want you to think about that as you listen to the seven rooms in Poe's tale. Okay, so here is a small section, just a small quote, or not a quote, but a small passage from As You Like It by William Shakespeare. And this is going to illuminate the seven ages, and we'll talk about The Tempest afterwards. So here's the quote, or here's the passage. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, his act being seven ages. At first, the infant mewling and puking in the nurse's arms, and then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face, creeping like snail unwillingly to school, and then the lover, sighing like furnace, with a woeful ballad made to his mistress's eyebrow, then a soldier, full of strange oaths, and bearded like the pard, jealous in honor, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation even in the cannon's mouth. And then the justice, in fair round belly, with good capon lined, with eyes severe and beard of formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances. And so he plays his part. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on noose, on nose and pouch on side, his youthful hose well saved, a world too wide for his shrunk shank, and his big manly voice, turning again toward childish treble, pipes and whistles in the sound. Last scene of all, that ends this strange eventful history, is second childishness and mere oblivion. Sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything. Sans, of course, means without. So that is the passage, All the World's a Stage, and the Seven Ages of Men. And you see he goes from infant into old age and infirmity and death. Now, again, I think that'll be relevant for your hearing of The Mask of the Red Death. And I want you to listen to the story and hear how people go inward in the story. And I want you to ask yourself while you're listening or reflect afterward before I give my commentary after you've heard the story, reflect on what do you think is the state of the revelers, the minds of the men who live in this place, and particularly the only named character, which is Prince Prospero. So what do we think is going on with Prince Prospero's inner soul during this event? So tune in or stay tuned for The Mask of the Red Death by Edgar Allan Poe. The Mask of the Red Death by Edgar Allan Poe. The Red Death had long devastated the country. No pestilence had ever been so fatal or so hideous. Blood was its avatar and its seal. The redness and the horror of blood. There were sharp pains and sudden dizziness, and then profuse bleeding at the pores with dissolution. The scarlet stains upon the body, and especially upon the face of the victim, were the pest ban, which shut him out from the aid and from the sympathy of his fellow men. And the whole seizure, progress, and termination of the disease were the incidents of half an hour. But the Prince Prospero was happy and dauntless and sagacious. When his dominions were half depopulated, he summoned to his presence 1,000 hale and light-hearted friends from among the knights and dames of his court, and with these retired to the deep seclusion of one of his castellated abbeys. This was an extensive and magnificent structure, the creation of the prince's own eccentric yet august taste. A strong and lofty wall girdled it in. This wall had gates of iron. The courtiers, having entered, brought furnaces and massy hammers and welded the bolts. They resolved to leave means neither of ingress or egress to the sudden impulses of despair or of frenzy from within. The abbey was amply provisioned. With such precautions, the courtiers might bid defiance to contagion. The external world could take care of itself. In the meantime, it was folly to grieve or to think. The prince had provided all the appliances of pleasure. There were buffoons, there were improvisatori, there were ballet dancers, there were musicians, there was beauty, there was wine. All these and security were within, without was the Red Death. It was toward the close of the fifth or sixth month of his seclusion, and while the pestilence raged most furiously abroad, that the Prince Prospero entertained his 1,000 friends at a masked ball of the most unusual magnificence. It was a voluptuous scene, that masquerade. But first let me tell you of the rooms in which it was held. There were 7, an imperial suite, and many palaces, however. Such suites form a long and straight vista, while the folding doors slide back nearly to the walls on either hand, so that the view of the whole extent is scarcely impeded. Here the case was very different, as might have been expected, from the Duke's love of the bazaar. The apartments were so irregularly disposed that the vision embraced but little more than one at a time. There was a sharp turn at every 20 or 30 yards, and at each turn a novel effect. To the right and left, in the middle of each wall, a tall and narrow Gothic window looked out upon a closed corridor, which pursued the windings of the suite. These windows were of stained glass, whose color varied in accordance with the prevailing hue of the decorations of the chamber into which it opened. That at the eastern extremity was hung, for example, in blue, and vividly blue were its windows. The second chamber was purple in its ornaments and tapestries, and here the panes were purple. The third was green throughout, and so were the casements. The fourth was furnished and lighted with orange. The fifth was white. The sixth was violet. The 7th apartment was closely shrouded in black velvet tapestries that hung all over the ceiling and down the walls, falling in heavy folds upon a carpet of the same material and hue. But in this chamber only, the color of the windows failed to correspond with the decorations. The panes here were scarlet, a deep blood color. Now, in no one of the 7 apartments was there any lamp or candelabrum amid the profusion of golden ornaments that lay scattered to and fro or depended from the roof. There was no light of any kind emanating from lamp or candle within the suite of chambers. But in the corridors that followed the suite, there stood opposite to each window a heavy tripod, bearing a brazier of fire that projected its rays through the tinted glass and so glaringly illumined the room. And thus were produced a multitude of gaudy and fantastic appearances. But in the western or black chamber, the effect of the firelight that streamed upon the dark hangings through the blood-tinted panes was ghastly in the extreme, and produced so wild a look upon the countenances of those who entered that there were few of the company bold enough to set foot within its precincts at all. It was in this apartment, also, that there stood against the western wall a gigantic clock of ebony. Its pendulum swung to and fro with a dull, heavy, monotonous clang, and when the minute hand made the circuit of the face and the hour was to be stricken, there came from the brazen lungs of the clock a sound which was clear and loud and deep and exceedingly musical, but of so peculiar a note and emphasis that, at each lapse of an hour, the musicians of the orchestra were constrained to pause momentarily in their performance to hearken the sound. And thus the waltzers perforce ceased their evolutions, and there was a brief disconcert of the whole gay company. And while the chimes of the clock yet rang, it was observed that the giddiest grew pale, and the more aged and sedate passed their hands over their brows, as if in confused reverie or meditation. But when the echoes had fully ceased, a light laughter at once pervaded the assembly. The musicians looked at each other and smiled as if at their own nervousness and folly, and made whispering vows, each to the other, that the next chiming of the clock should produce in them no similar emotion. And then, after the lapse of 60 minutes, which embrace 3,600 seconds of the time that flies, there came yet another chiming of the clock, and then were the same disconcert and tremulousness and meditation as before. But, in spite of these things, it was a gay and magnificent revel. The tastes of the Duke were peculiar. He had a fine eye for colors and effects. He disregarded the decora of mere fashion. His plans were bold and fiery, and his conceptions glowed with barbaric luster. There are some who would have thought him mad. His followers felt that he was not. It was necessary to hear and see and touch him to be sure that he was not. He had directed, in great part, the movable embellishments of the seven chambers upon occasion of this great fete, and it was his own guiding taste which had given character to the masquerades. Be sure they were grotesque. There were much glare and glitter and piquancy and phantasm, much of what has been since seen in Hernani. There were arabesque figures with unsuited limbs and appointments. There were delirious fancies such as the madmen fashions. There was much of the beautiful, much of the wanton, much of the bizarre, something of the terrible, and not a little bit of that which might have excited disgust. To and fro in the seven chambers there stalked, in fact, a multitude of dreams. And these, the dreams, writhed in and about, taking hue from the rooms, and causing the wild music of the orchestra to seem as the echo of their steps. And anon, there strikes the ebony clock which stands in the hall of the velvet. And then, for a moment, all is still, and all is silent save the voice of the clock. The dreams are still stiff frozen as they stand. But the echoes of the chime die away. They have endured but an instant, and a light, half-subdued laughter floats after them as they depart. And now again the music swells, and the dreams live, and writhe to and fro more merrily than ever, taking hue from the many tinted windows through which stream the rays from the tripods. But to the chamber, which lies most westerly of the seven, there are now none of the maskers who venture, for the night is waning away, and there flows a ruddier light through the blood-colored panes. And the blackness of the sable drapery appalls, and to him whose foot falls upon the sable carpet, there comes from the near clock of ebony a muffled peal, more solemnly emphatic than any which reaches their ears who indulge in the more remote gaieties of the other apartments. But these other apartments were densely crowded, and in them beat feverishly the heart of life, and the revel went whirlingly on until at length there commenced the sounding of midnight upon the clock. And then the music ceased, as I have told, and the evolutions of the waltzers were quieted, and there was an uneasy cessation of all things as before. But now there were 12 strokes to be sounded by the bell of the clock, and thus it happened, perhaps, that more of thought crept, with more of time, into the meditations of the thoughtful among those who reveled. And thus, too, it happened, perhaps, that before the last echoes of the last chime had utterly sunk into silence, there were many individuals in the crowd who had found leisure to become aware of the presence of a masked figure which had arrested the attention of no single individual before. And the rumor of this new presence having spread itself whisperingly around, there arose at length from the whole company a buzz or murmur, expressive of disapprobation and surprise, then finally of terror, of horror, and of disgust. In an assembly of phantasms such as I have painted, it may well be supposed that no ordinary appearance could have excited such sensation. In truth, the masquerade license of the night was nearly unlimited. But the figure in question had out-Heroded Herod and gone beyond the bounds of even the prince's indefinite decorum. There are chords in the heart of the most reckless which cannot be touched without emotion, even with the utterly lost, to whom life and death are equally jests. There are matters of which no jest can be made. The whole company, indeed, seemed now deeply to feel that in the costume and bearing of the stranger neither wit nor propriety existed. The figure was tall and gaunt, and shrouded from head to foot in the habiliments of the grave. The mask which concealed the visage was made so nearly to resemble the countenance of a stiffened corpse that the closest scrutiny must have had difficulty in detecting the cheat. And yet all this might have been endured, if not approved, by the mad revelers around. But the mummer had gone so far as to assume the type of the Red Death. His vesture was dabbled in blood, and his broad brow, with all the features of the face, was besprinkled with the scarlet horror. When the eyes of Prince Prospero fell upon this spectral image, which with a slow and solemn movement, as if more fully to sustain its role, stalked to and fro among the waltzers, he was seen to be convulsed, in the first moment with a strong shudder either of terror or distaste, but in the next, his brow reddened with rage. "Who dares?" he demanded hoarsely of the courtiers who stood near him. "Who dares insult us with this blasphemous mockery? Seize him and unmask him, that we may know whom we have to hang at sunrise from the battlements." It was in the eastern of Blue Chamber in which stood the Prince Prospero as he uttered these words. They rang throughout the seven rooms loudly and clearly, for the prince was a bold and robust man, and the music had become hushed at the waving of his hand. It was in the blue room where stood the prince, with a group of pale courtiers by his side. At first, as he spoke, there was a slight rushing movement of this group in the direction of the intruder, who at the moment was all so near at hand, and now, with deliberate and stately step, made closer approach to the speaker. But from a certain nameless awe with which the mad assumptions of the mummer had inspired the whole party, there were found none who put forth hand to seize him, so that, unimpeded, he passed within a yard of the prince's person. And while the vast assembly, as if with one impulse, shrank from the centers of the rooms to the walls, he made his way uninterruptedly, but with the same solemn and measured step which had distinguished him from the first, through the blue chamber to the purple, and the purple to the green, through the green to the orange, through this again to the white, and even thence to the violet, ere a decided movement had been made to arrest him. It was then, however, that the Prince Prospero, maddening with rage and the shame of his own momentary cowardice, rushed hurriedly through the six chambers, while none followed him on account of a deadly terror that had seized upon all. He bore aloft a drawn dagger, and had approached, in rapid impetuosity, to within 3 or 4 feet of the retreating figure, when the latter, having attained the extremity of the velvet apartment, turned suddenly and confronted his pursuer. There was a sharp cry, and the dagger dropped gleaming upon the sable carpet, upon which, instantly afterward, fell prostrate in death the Prince Prospero. Then, summoning the wild courage of despair, a throng of the revelers at once threw themselves into the black apartment, and seizing the mummer, whose tall figure stood erect and motionless within the shadow of the ebony clock, gasped in unutterable horror at finding the grave cerements and corpse-like mask, which they handled with so violent a rudeness, untenanted by any tangible form. And now was acknowledged the presence of the Red Death. He had come like a thief in the night, and one by one dropped the revelers in the blood-bedewed halls of their revel, and died each in the despairing posture of his fall. And the life of the ebony clock went out with that of the last of the gay. And the flames of the tripods expired, and darkness and decay and the red death held illimitable dominion over all. I hope you enjoyed hearing that as much as I enjoyed reading that. Now, on the surface, this story seems pretty simple, right? On the surface, it's about a rich man who leaves society. He goes onto his island like Prospero in Tempest. So he's separated from society. He brings revelry with him. He brings all the people that he wants to bring. And he says, forget it to everybody else. And, leave them to their own devices. They're all dying of this horrible red death. And he's not going to worry about it because he's wealthy, he's capable, he can isolate forever if he wants to because he has that kind of power and money. But then, of course, the Red Death eventually finds him, and there's there's always this doom that is pervading throughout this whole story. We hear it right from the beginning, and it seems to follow us everywhere we go. So we get an opening paragraph that tells us the Red Death had long devastated the country. No pestilence had ever been so fatal or so hideous. And it's a description of the sharp pains, the horror of blood, the profuse bleeding, the disillusion, the scarlet stains. So we have this paragraph that just describes in vivid detail the horror of the reality of what's going on with this mask of, or this red death. And then the second paragraph starts, but the Prince Prospero was happy and dauntless and sagacious, wise. And he waited until his population was depopulated to half, so dead by half, and then he summoned all these people to his house, and they had a strong and lofty wall, girdled it in. This wall had gates of iron. The courtiers, having entered, brought furnaces and massy hammers and welded the bolts, so they locked themselves into this place. And the idea was, with such precautions, the courtiers might bid defiance to contagion. The external world could take care of itself. In the meantime, it was folly to grieve or to think. The prince had provided all the appliances of pleasure. So we get a feeling that this is a story that Poe is trying to tell us that we actually have something that that it's wrong, for instance, to abscond from your responsibilities, from your duties, that there's something cowardly and dastardly about this act. And when you look up some of the analyses on the internet, that's what you'll find some of them talking about. And they're not fully wrong that that's in this story, that this man has just taken all these resources away from this dying population, a dying population that made all those resources possible. He takes them all, takes all these resources, locks them in his place with 1,000 people that he wants, and then lets everyone else die, and he doesn't care about them. And then, of course, the justice happens when, during the revelry, you have this figure that is looking like some symbolic aspect of the Red Death, and he comes in and kills Prince Prospero. When Prince Prospero finally goes with his dagger, and his dagger falls from his hand, he falls on the sable carpet. The sable carpet has already been established as being black, so he falls dead, and then all the other people die in the figure that they had. When in the last moments, the revelers had a burst of courage, and they tackled essentially the masked man, and they find that he had incorporated or discorporated. There was nothing there. He was no corporal figure, and so basically he disappears like he was a ghost. So you get this idea that the justice is that no amount of wealth can stop the plague. This has been a theme of plague since, the ancient Greeks started studying them more specifically and conscientiously. When you hear that the plagues don't have a care about your religion, about your race, about your wealth, about your status in society, that they'll kill the young, the old, the the rich and the poor. It kills everybody equally. And so it's a kind of equalizer, these viruses. And that's kind of what you're seeing in Poe on a first surface level. And that is absolutely true. But dig deeper. I always suggest, especially with a great writer like Poe, to dig deeper. Because there's this the plot of this story is like a three-sentence plot. A rich prince absconds into his castle with 1,000 revelers while a horrible plague is devastating the countryside. In a masquerade party that he puts on for his people, a mysterious figure who looks like the Red Death appears. Then they all die. And that's basically it. That's the story. It's a very simple story, and it's lots of symbolism, or at least not a detailed out depth plot. And in fact, there's only one character named, as I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, and that's Prince Prospero. So it's not deeply about characterization. And yet, it is deeply about the character of Prospero, if we dig deeper. So before we dig deeper, I want to read a poem by Poe to kind of give some hints about what we're going to expect from this palace. And there are famous poems about, and you know, the analogy of a palace to the mind. And this is something that we're going to see here, I think, is the that we don't want to take necessarily the palace, this castle of the mad Prince Prospero, as a literal castle, right? We don't want to necessarily take it that way, that we instead want to take it as the mind of Prince Prospero, and that the castle is a mind. And there's a poem called "My Mind to Me a Kingdom Is," and it's a whole by I believe Edward Dwyer. I don't have it in front of me, so I can't. If I'm wrong, I apologize. But in this poem, you know, it's all an analogy, basically analogizing or comparing the mind of you, of every individual man, to a kingdom. You know, who do you let in? How big, high are your walls? Are you open to free trade, right? Do you allow other people to have ideas in the kingdom, or do you have a dictatorship where everything is locked out? You don't let anybody. And we all know people who have minds like that, right? Who are completely closed off from all outside ideas, and therefore they kind of stew in the ideas they have. And that, you know, you can analogize that to a kingdom with the king who's a dictator who doesn't allow anybody into his borders, right? Or through his borders, so he gets no outside ideas and he gets no outside nourishment either. And so they're going to decay and die. So that's just one. Let me read this poem called "The Haunted Palace" by Edgar Allan Poe that kind of gives you the analogy, or you can think metaphor, between a palace and the mind. And in this case, I think Edgar Allan Poe's mind in particular. So it's about 5-6 stanzas. So it's not super short, but it's not long either. It'll only take like, you know, 3-4 minutes to read it. "In the greenest of our valleys, by good angels tenanted, once a fair and stately palace, radiant palace, reared its head. In the monarch, thought's dominion is stood there. Never seraph spread a pinion over fabric half so fair. Banners yellow, glorious golden, on its roof did float and flow. This, all this, was in the olden time long ago. And every gentle air that dallied in that sweet day, along the rampart plumed and pallid, a winged odor went away. Wanderers in that happy valley, through two luminous windows, saw spirits moving musically to a lute's well-tuned law, round about a throne where, sitting Porphyrogene, in state his glory well befitting, the ruler of the realm was seen, and all with pearl and ruby glowing was the fair palace door, through which came flowing, 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 and sparkling evermore, a troop of echoes, whose sweet duty was but to sing. and voices of surpassing beauty, the wit and wisdom of their king. But evil things, in robes of sorrow, assailed the monarch's high estate. Ah, let us mourn, for never morrow shall dawn upon him desolate. And round about his home the glory that blushed and bloomed is but a dim remembered story of the old time entombed. And travelers, now within that valley, through the red lighten windows see vast forms that move fantastically to a discordant melody. While like a ghastly rapid river, through the pale door a hideous throng rush out forever and laugh, but smile no more. That's the end. So I won't go into a detailed analysis of this poem right now, but I think you probably got a sense of the gist of it, right? And think about what a haunting means. I mean, a haunting, when you think about the word, what it conveys is, you know, imagine a house that's haunted. It's the remnants of the past stay there. And that's what a Gothic story, kind of one of the deep elements of a Gothic story is that you have this old castle, and you have this, you know, or this old mansion or palace, and you have the remnants of the past are kind of infecting it, almost like a virus, almost like a disease, you know, these old ancient bodies. And the Gothic tale, by the way, came about in the late 1700s during around the time of all the revolutions we hear about. And one of the things that the revolutions in Europe were discussing was shucking off of the old habiliments of caste and society and the kings and monarchs. And that's a big part of what they were trying to shuck off. But at the same time, they couldn't quite do that because they were haunted by, you know, thousands of years of tradition and the way that things have always been and the way that people always acted. And so to get rid of these habiliments was very difficult for them because they were constantly haunted by this. And so you get this Gothic tale, and it tends to be a story about a castle, and these people go into this castle, and the past is kind of in some weird way, with ghosts and mummies and weird, you know, creeps in the night, are torturing and tormenting the people that are currently living, right? So it's very similar to what they're dealing with in the 18th century. And if you think of a modern example, The Haunting of Hill House, which is a show I really enjoyed on Netflix, a horror show. Or a scary show. And they're haunted, the people, the living people are haunted by this one night and how it affected and kind of destroyed the minds and the lives and it, you know, and steered the minds and the lives of this family. And it's this one night is haunted, you know, the remnants of the past stay with them throughout their living days. And that's what a haunting, I mean, the word haunting is a very powerful word, because it's very real, I think. It refers to something real, which is this, the way that our memories and our minds work, where there's something about the past that still remains. And sometimes that thing can be a disease, a harmful thing that we must get rid of. Now, in the poem, The Haunted Palace, for instance, it starts off with the greenest of our valleys by good angels tenanted, right? There's angels living here. Once a fair and stately palace, so it's once a fair and stately palace, radiant palace reared its head, and the monarch thought's dominion is stood there. So you have the strong monarch, never seraph spread a pinion, wings, over fabric half so fair. So you have this beautiful, wonderful, perfect palace, and you get description of it being, you know, glorious and golden. This, all this was in the olden time long ago. So we have this big, immense, powerful, majestic palace long ago. So what is it like today? Wanderers in that happy valley through two luminous windows saw spirits moving musically to a lute's well-tuned law. Round about a throne where sitting Porphyrogene in state his glory well befitting the ruler of the realm was seen. And then as they keep looking, a troop of echoes and think about echoes and haunting, it's very similar, right? Whose sweet duty was but to sing in voices of surpassing beauty, the wit and wisdom of their king. So they're seeing All this, but evil things in robes of sorrow assailed the monarch's high estate. Ah, let us mourn, for never morrow shall dawn upon him desolate. And round about his home of the glory that blushed and bloomed is but a dim remembered story of the old time entombed. And travelers now within that valley through the red-litten windows see vast forms that move fantastically to a discordant melody, while, like a ghastly rapid river, through the pale door a hideous throng rush out forever and laugh, but smile no more. So in the second half, you get, like, in the olden days, you get this beautiful picture. You could go, you know, look of this palace. Travelers could go look in the windows and see these ghosts of the past that were, you know, and you could think of the ghosts of the past as like the paintings and just like what was there in the past, and that they're singing of the wit and wisdom of their king. But then the second half, as you see, it turns really evil, especially the last two stanzas, where these evil things are there. And so there's also a dark side to it. And we could see this in the work of Edgar Allan Poe himself and possibly his own mind. This is probably his view of his own mind. So when we return to the Mask of the Red Death, and we have this elaborate palace, it was a voluptuous scene, that masquerade. And he discusses the castellated abbeys, the extensive and magnificent structure, the creation of the prince's own eccentric and yet august taste. So we have this picture being drawn by Poe of this palace that is in, and if I have hopefully argued to you that the palace, it turns out in the Red Mask, the Mask of the Red Death, is actually in the mind of Prince Prospero. And so what we're seeing, and you get a lot of hints about this. One of the hints is that Prospero is a shout out, in a sense, to the Tempest's Prospero, who is a mage who has, through his magical powers, essentially created this world separated from the rest of society. And it's all, and I'll give you one last little hint at, or one little last argument at the end of this whole thing from Shakespeare's The Tempest to kind of hammer this home. But you have other kind of indications in the story itself. Even if you're not familiar with Shakespeare, you still have this dreamlike sense. For instance, the ebony clock, which, by the way, inspired me to write a short story called The Ebony Clock, A Quarantine Nightmare. So I hope you go check that out at Troubadour Magazine. I think it's a really good one. But you get this clock that, you know, is moving to and fro, and the revelers are dancing, kind of, you can kind of picture them dancing maniacally, and they're, you know, just having a grand old time. But then when the clock rings at the rays of the hour, they all stop as if, you know, reflecting. And that kind of dreamlike sense, I mean, you can think of movies where people are dancing, and, you know, I'm thinking of silly movies like Labyrinth and Hocus Pocus, where they're like, you know, dancing and dancing and dancing, and then, you know, something will eventually stop them. But it's a kind of a monstrous kind of a dance where it's not normal nor joyous. It's just, you know, writhing around because they have no other option, but then they stop because of the ringing of the chiming of the bell. And it's that chiming of the bell and the kind of cadence of that makes it kind of indicated that this is a dream, which, you know, whose dream would it be? Well, there's only one character really, and that's Prince Prospero. The folding doors slid back nearly so to the walls on either hand, so that the view of the whole extent is scarcely impeded. Here the case was very different, as might have been expected from the Duke's love of the bazaar. The apartments were so irregularly disposed that the vision embraced but little more than one at a time. There was a sharp turn at every 20 or 30 yards, and at each turn a novel effect. That is a dream. That's the description of a dream, that the dreamer who's, you know, if you think about it, like from egocentric standpoint, like I can always see what's in front of me, even in a dream. And, you know, there's a sharp turn. And when I turn around that corner, it's a whole nother world, right? And that's what he's kind of showing here, Poe, I think. So I think there's a lot of evidence that this is a description of a dream. Now, what is the meaning of that? Now, of course, you have, by the way, before I forget, there's seven rooms that kind of coincide with the seven ages of man that we talked about at the beginning. And in that this room, there is that big ebony clock. And let me actually read the description of the waltzers as the clock chimes. And thus the waltzers perforce, like by an outside force is what perforce basically means. And thus the waltzers perforce ceased their evolutions. And there was a brief disconcert of the whole gay company. And while the chimes of the clock yet rang, it was observed that the giddiest grew pale, and the more aged and sedate passed their hands over their brows as if in confused reverie or meditation. But when the echoes had fully ceased, a light laughter at once pervaded the assembly. The musicians looked at each other and smiled as if at their own nervousness and folly, and made whispering vows each to the other that the next chiming of the clock should produce in them no similar emotion. And then, after the lapse of 60 minutes, which embraced 3,600 seconds of the time that flies, there came yet another chiming of the clock, and then there was the same disconcert and tremulousness and meditation as before. Now, I contend that this clock, which is made a big deal of, he describes it was in this apartment also that there stood against the western wall a gigantic clock of ebony in the dull, hell heavy... that this emphasis on time is an emphasis on the reality of time that exists no matter what you do, more even more than the mask of the red or the Red Death itself, is that time is something that exists. And so if we take this, you know, let's say you do agree with me that this is a dream particularly, and that in this dream, you know, whether he's sleeping or just daydreaming, you have this Prince Prospero, you know, I imagine him maybe this older man or this, you know, older life, part of his life, sitting in a room by himself, essentially. Maybe he's trapped while his whole world is dying. Or maybe there is no plague and it's just a plague in his mind. I mean, the plague does kill faster even than the bubonic plague. So it's a horrific plague. But he's this man who's sitting by himself and he's contemplating this whole world that he's existing in. And you know, he's kind of living in this world that he's created in his mind, this world of revelry and pleasure seeking. And then the clock rings, which is a kind of a reminder, or it takes him, the real man, outside of his dream for a moment, which is why his revelers pause and grow pale, because it kind of shocks through him. And it's kind of the clicking of the clock of doom that's coming, and we're all going to die and he's going to die. And so there's this sense that this, you know, phantasm is all created in his mind. And you get a sense that it's a mad mind. There were delirious fancies, quote, there were delirious fancies such as the madman fashions. There was much of the beautiful, much of the wanton, much of the bizarre, something of the terrible, and not a little of that which might have excited disgust. So we have this figure. And this figure is, you know, Prospero, which, by the way, can also be translated. We can think of it as prosperity. So in this prosperity, he has quarantined himself away from the world, away from everything else, away from the responsibilities outside of his castle. And he's allowed this to happen. And then he revels in these pleasures in his mind. Now, maybe they're real revels. You could take them, you know, I think there is a tinge of the ambiguous. This is Edgar Allan Poe, so you don't have to agree with me that it's definitely a dream, although I think it's very indicative of a dream. And so, you know, I take it as a psychological story, not a supernatural story, because if it's not a dream, then it's a supernatural story, right? And the Red Death is this figure that's a ghost that comes in. I think it's psychological in that it's representative of the fear that Prince Prospero has lived in. And that's kind of where, you know, I wanted to, before I ended, I wanted to give you one last little passage from Shakespeare to kind of hammer home this idea of what's going on in this story about this being an idea or a a metaphor, an analogy for the palace of the mind. And if you listen or read this story again, I think it'll have a different meaning to think about the kind of darkness that is in Prince Prospero's mind. And I'll talk about that in a second. Let me read this last aspect from Prospero, from Shakespeare's Tempest. This is Shakespeare's Prospero. And he says, our revels, you know, pay attention to that. Quote, our revels now are ended. These, our actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits and are melted into air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-clapped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit shall dissolve. And like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. Now, I will contest that this story is one of the critical stories for us to know today during COVID-19. Because you are Prince Prospero. You in your house, reveling today, watching your shows, wondering about when this will all end, allowing this to occur, and not just the virus, but everything that is occurring in our society, taking no action and just blocking yourself from the world is the damage that can be caused, the psychological darkness that will prevail in the minds of those who allow for this kind of forced and quarantining that's going on. And even accepting and happily or even giddily accepting this kind of torture that is occurring and the lack of going out into the world and living the world. And this, you know, story of this Prince Prospero and the masquerade that he puts on, which is, remember, masquerade meaning pretense. This is what's going on. We've put on this pretense, this story that we're telling ourselves of this unbeatable threat and of this issue going on with how much problems we have in our government and in our society, that we have to shut everything down for fears. And that's what we're getting today, is fears of going out because of untenanted facts that we don't have all the information yet. And so we're living in terror of something that we don't even have a lot of information in. So in our minds, it's as bad as the Red Death, even though there's no evidence that COVID-19 is anywhere near that. But in our minds, it is. And this is what happens to the mind of someone who lives in fear. And that's what I wanted to leave you with, is that this is, of course, a virus that is a very scary virus. But there are many viruses. Influenza killed 80,000 people last year. And some of the models that we're hearing are so scary. And they're, when you look at them, though, they're based on so little evidence because it's too early to have enough evidence. And so we're modeling out these horrific things that I've even seen, somewhere upwards of 10 million deaths, which is horrific. And yet they're based on very little evidence. And so we all live in more and more fear based on littler or smaller and smaller amounts of evidence. And this is something that worries me, and why I wanted to read stories like this, so that we can see what fear does to you. Because even if this is a terrible thing, Prince Prospero should not have blocked himself off and lived in revelry. He should have gone out. He should have used the resources he can to go out and fight and try to help the half of his people who were remaining, who had not been depopulated. And that's the message that I think we should take from this, is that what fear tells us and shows us, and what Poe shows us in the fear, is what it does to the mind, what it will do to your mind, what it has done without your knowledge, without your awareness, without your approval to your mind. That is the message of the Mask of the Red Death.